It's The Wonky Show. We talk deferrals and the new clearing plus, research sustainability, and a big plan for widening participation. It's all coming up.
I don't think we live in a world where you let your children do things. I think we've got to encourage them to take big decisions for themselves. I would be encouraging my children, who have all been to university, six universities, to grab opportunities that were available now that weren't available before. I think some of my kids.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, stuck at home like everybody else who doesn't need to get their eyesight checked. And as usual, we have three brilliant guests to row us gently across the peaceful koi ponds of higher education policy. In Chepstow, we have Jenny Shaw, Student Experience Director for Unite Students. Jenny, give us a moment of zen.
Oh, well, my moment of zen is we found a little walk through the woods that no one else seems to know about, which is, you know, it's like gold dust because people just flock to every lovely walk there is in this area. So we're keeping it secret, and that's our quiet, peaceful moment of zen.
And in Maidenhead, we have David Sweeney, Executive Chair of Research England. David, your moment of zen.
My treat over the lockdown is watching all of the episodes of Borgen, the Danish political drama, which I missed first time round. And events happen in that programme that are surreal and similar to visits to Barnard Castle. It gives you a moment of complete alternate reality.
And in a really small farm outside of Barnard Castle, it's David Kernahan. That's DK to you and me, Wonky's associate editor and correlation czar. DK, your moment of zen, please.
Well, I've been working on a lot of music, a lot of kind of musical and recording projects with my band. I've also been arranging stuff for orchestra, which is something I've not done for about 20 years. It's been lovely getting back into that.
When someone says they've been working on their music, I think of Ross from Friends with his keyboard. Boom, 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 boom. So let's dive right in. We're seeing increasing amounts of interest in whether students are planning on showing up in September. And we're also learning more every day about the new Clearing Plus system. Jenny, what's going on?
Well, I think we all want to know how many students are going to come to university this year. It does tend to focus the mind, doesn't it, around issues of financial viability. And there's been polling on it. So London Economics have done some polling with YouthSight, and they've found that the vast majority, 86% of, I think it's UK and EU students, will still come to university in September if things are normal. But there'll be a 17% drop-off if there are still some restrictions in place. So in other words, if we've still got an active pandemic, and of course, that's something that none of us can control, which is a little disempowering. They've also found that a quarter of students would consider switching their course during clearing. And this is something that, of course, does give students some control back a little bit nearer to the time. So you could see how attractive that would be. And students now have access to Clearing Plus from early July, which is a super sophisticated, personalised approach, which uses an algorithm to help them find the most suitable and relevant course. Now, whether or not you think that's sinister probably depends on how old you are. And actually, if you're a student, it's going to be the sort of technology, I think, that you probably understand quite well and navigate around quite well. But of course, it's all taking place in a context of huge uncertainty. And I think we shouldn't cling too hard to the stats at this stage. Attitudes are quite volatile because actually all of us are still adapting to a situation. And what might seem unacceptable to students right now might not do in September. Certainly, we're doing some polling next week about the health and safety and support measures that might be reassuring to students and their parents in that decision to come back to university. And actually, DK, you've done some great work pointing out that actually the reason that people might choose a university is quite nuanced. It's got a quite a big emotional component to it. And actually going to university at all is quite an emotionally loaded decision. When I was thinking about this, I thought, well, it's probably somewhere between buying a house and getting married in terms of that weight of life decision. But we do tend to default to this idea that it's a simple cost benefit analysis for students. And actually, there's some real dangers in baking that into our response and also into our survey questions. So that's something that could lead us astray, I think.
Thanks, Jenny. DK, tell us, what have we learned about Clearing Plus this week that we didn't know before?
So just to kind of backtrack to the start of the story, we initially heard about Clearing Plus. It was released alongside the government support for universities back at the start of May. And Exactly, the Nunn bailout. And it was seemed to be pointed at an idea as, okay, we can help students get into the best courses. They don't have to go into terrible courses anymore because of their own lack of knowledge. It's, of course, it's not like that at all. It is only for students that are in clearing, either by dint of choosing to be in clearing or by not meeting their grades. And the technology, effectively, the main thing it does is it will show you stuff that's a bit like the courses you've applied to or are looking at, but is the entrance rates are linked to the grades that you've actually got, the stuff that you're actually playing with, rather than just letting you look at everything. Now, I actually think this is potentially dangerous. As we all know, during the clearing period, and especially, I think, during this year, the grades are negotiable. You can ring up a university and you can say, okay, I've not quite got your grades, but I've nearly got your grades. I would love to do your course. I'm a great student for the following reasons. And they might let you in. Exactly the same thing has happened to many, many people I know, and it continues to happen. This is why we have clearing, in a way. It is a second chance. And the idea that students are being steered only to ask about in clearing courses where they have definitely got the grade, that's actually kind of limiting. It's almost, it is doing the opposite of what it's been designed.
I mean, David, it seems like, I mean, there's obviously a lot of unknowns about what applicants' behaviour is gonna look like. I mean, would you, looking at it now, would you be planning on letting your children go to university or letting your kids go if they're at uni age?
I don't think we live in a world where you let your children do things. I think we've got to encourage them to take big decisions for themselves. I would be encouraging my children, who have all been to university, six universities, to grab opportunities that were available now that weren't available before. I think some of my kids did not so well in their first go at university, but in those cases, universities offered them second goes, actually, through master's courses that have transformed their lives. I think that there are so many opportunities for people who are willing to grab them, and this is a time for looking for exactly that. So I think a scheme that narrows down student choice, potential student choice, is not so great as one which opens out new opportunities.
I mean, it's fair to say it's not the intention, I think, behind the Clearing Plus system. I mean, I think it's fair to say this might be, that might be one of the unintended consequences, but the intention isn't to narrow it, and we don't know for sure what will happen. I mean, Jenny, on the face of it, do you think that, you know, this will help people get in, more people get into the right sort of courses, or also are you also worried about the kind of potential narrowing effect?
I think the fact is we just don't know, and one of the things about unintended consequences is that they are unintended, and you don't actually get to find out what they are until after the fact. So we're doing this in quite a strange year, and it is a bit of an experiment. So I just don't think, I think there is a potential for it to narrow choices. I think there is the potential for bias unintentionally to creep into the way it's done. I think there is the potential for some students to be disadvantaged by it, but obviously it has not been designed in that way. It's been designed to be as good and as fair as possible. And I think one of the positives that I've read is actually the emphasis that was put on the user experience, which I think is often overlooked, but actually the feedback from students was that they wanted a better user experience. They wanted it to be easier to navigate because that would be helpful to them. Whether the algorithm delivers what they need right now, I just don't think we know.
There is a provider angle to all this as well, because providers that are offering courses can change settings in such a way that their courses can target particular students that they've been having trouble recruiting in the past. So, I mean, the obvious example that providers would use this to target students that have got the right grades, but they can also use it to target students that come from poorer quintile number one. So the people that are least likely to go to university. This, of course, is a requirement for many providers in their access and participation planning with OFS to recruit more and more of these students. So they can actually use this scheme to make sure that their course gets in front of the students from those particular disadvantaged groups that otherwise wouldn't be considering it. We don't really know, as everyone said, really, we don't really know exactly how this is going to work in practice, but it is one to watch. And I, for one, in the back end of next January, at which point we will probably still be in lockdown. I will be looking very closely at the application data for evidence of where this might have had an impact.
So I think that's really interesting, actually, if universities can set the parameters for contextual admissions, because that's something that hasn't been done in that way before. It'd be interesting to see whether people do that and what the impact might be.
And I mean, I'm also interested, I mean, it's not the conversation so much for today, but the, like so many things, how this whole crisis will change long-term policy and also behaviours and expectations. And it seems to me that the government has made its mind up that PQA is the right way to go. And I wonder if this situation will kind of give them a hook to hang that policy on. And I mean, David, you've been around these arguments for a long time in different cycles, as it's kind of fallen in and out of favor. Could you imagine us ending in a kind of PQA type system in the next couple of years?
Well, yes, I certainly could imagine that. I think it's a very tricky issue, because you've got to look at it from the point of view of the applicants. And I think there are certainly some who are significantly disadvantaged by the way it's done now. There are also quite a lot, I think, who have more time to think and plan in the current system. So I think there's no right or wrong. Where I think we are, though, is that things that were considered unthinkable and impractical are now worth thinking about. And although the disruption this year will be immense, I think we will get through that disruption, and things that were thought impractical will turn out to be possible. So I think it just resets the decisions around PQA, and I think we can have a much more informed discussion and lay aside some of the strong views we have about practicality that perhaps are not now justified.
Mm. Well, from your lips to God's ears, I like the sound of a more informed conversation about PQA. Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Claire Taylor, working for Sums Consulting. It's a consultancy owned and run by universities. I've been working with university timetablers to understand the art of the possible for September 2020. We already know lectures are out, replaced by asynchronous online broadcasts available to students on demand. But what should universities do about small group teaching? I think there's two key questions that timetablers are asking, which will help them decide what to do about face-to-face teaching for September. One's about the rooms. How many rooms are still usable under social distancing rules? One university we spoke to estimated a reduction of 30 to 40%. And question two, what's the occupancy of those rooms likely to be? We think perhaps 15 to 25% of their full capacity. So what's this going to mean for face-to-face small group teaching? We're going to see multiple instances, double, triple teaching, much longer teaching days for academics. Or our senior leadership teams are going to have to make some difficult decisions about which cohorts to prioritise for face-to-face learning for September. Check out our longer blog on the Wonky site for more details on this.
Right, Nesta's out with a new report about the missing $4 billion. That sounds like a lot of money, David. What on earth's going on?
Well, I think this report has been some time in the gestation, and as Tom and Richard say, they've talked to a lot of people, and I am one of those people. I think it is a fantastic report with some great data attached that opens out things, provides, in fact, the informed basis for discussion that I was just referring to on PQA. It provides a chance to have a debate about where we're going to get to and what I'm afraid I'm willing to call the new normal. I think we have a system that has served us very, very well at delivering some very strong outcomes. I think probably we need a slightly broader set of outcomes, and certainly we need outcomes that mean that, for example, UKRI can put into practice its mission as being a research and innovation agency for the whole country. We have had constant research concentration. There is a very strong investment in parts of the country who have delivered on that investment. I think we want to provide an opportunity according to Forth and Jones, to look at that opportunity being available right across the country.
What were your key takeaways from the report and its recommendations?
Well, I think there's a lot of recommendations, some of which are practical and simple, but nevertheless challenging. Some of them aimed in the direction of my organisation, and I'm not going to comment on those, but I do appreciate the case that's being made. I think the key take home is that research and development is at the heart of economic growth across the whole country. That's, I think, what we believe and the government believes. But we have given undue attention to some parts of the country for a series of reasons that have been clearly set out. And now the take-home message is, why should we not invest in research and development right across the country and demonstrate that the benefits that follow will be available to all?
And I mean, David, you're a member of the Research Sustainability Task Force, and it's been, you know, there was a bit of a row about, you know, who was on it and, you know, naming the names. But it does seem like a fairly broad and sensible group. But I guess my question is, do you think that the government is taking seriously what you and other experts about research and innovation are bringing to it at this point?
Oh, I do think the government's taking seriously inputs of all kinds. I think the discussions that are happening around how we handle the immediate situation, because the government aspiration for research and development, which I've already described in the place context, remains articulated very strongly, and I'm sure we'll look and see if it is articulated strongly again. The government's got an aspiration. We've got to ensure that we have the research capacity and capability to deliver on that, and indeed broaden it so that it's available in more places. So really the task force is about how we do stuff now, but also research sustainability is clearly an issue that has been brought into sharp focus by the shock the system has had. And part of the agenda, therefore, is looking ahead, again, being slightly trite, to look at what the new normal might be and how we might get there. So Richard and Tom have produced a great set of proposals for one element of the new normal. I'm sure that others will emerge, and I'm sure the government wants to listen to all of those and develop concrete plans to deliver.
DK, on the kind of political side, it feels like the research innovation side of what goes on in the landscape inside universities and around that ecosystem is the bit that the government is keen on protecting and shoring up to a certain extent. It doesn't feel the same, doesn't feel like there's the same attention to the rest of universities, you know, the teaching and the learning and the experience. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, I don't agree. I think the government is very concerned that the ability to deliver high level skills and provide us with a workforce that's right for the jobs of tomorrow is very strong. I think actually the view of universities goes way beyond the economic approach. At the heart of regeneration in huge parts of the country is culture. And our universities are major centres for that. So I think this is a balanced approach. However, the government's always been very clearly involved in research. It's a very, very major funder, and we have national plans. I think the government is not dictating how teaching is carried out. I think that's very much a responsibility of the universities, and I think it's admirable that they're not getting in to some of the fine detail around that. And it's an opportunity for universities to take some new directions, as we've been talking about, because they work with students and identify collectively opportunities that are available to them. So I don't see it at all as the government not interested. I just think the nature of their interest is different, and it rightly so.
DK, tell us about the NESTA report's QR recommendations.
Yeah, now this is the bit that I imagine raised most of the sector eyebrows this morning. A lot of it, a lot of what's in the report is, we need to get better at funding R&D in the regions. And that, I think, is largely uncontroversial. We've been saying that for a long, long time. But I'm just going to read you the actual text of, well, It's recommendation 9. Block grant funding for research and knowledge exchange in universities. It should be regionally weighted to reflect current regional public underfunding of research and development. The long-standing explicit preference to London in the quality research funding formula, that's the QR funding we all know and love. Thank you, David, for that funding. That should be removed. So this is a big, big shift. There's long been the expectation that, I mean, QR primarily pays for staff. It pays staff salaries, and those salaries cover staff living costs. Living costs are simply higher in London. And as much as we might like the idea of spending less in London and more elsewhere, the problem is for the spend we make in London, we'll be getting less activity per pound of spend simply because it's more expensive to do pretty much anything in London. So there's a lot of other stuff in there aimed at UCRI, which obviously we can't expect David Swinney to talk about at this point. But there would be a high level advisory committee of the nations and reasons to look at the overall spread of project funding, and there'd be expansions to existing funds like the Strengths in Places. The other thing I spotted in this report, which I thought was interesting, was figure 10, which is a lovely block diagram of all of the different players in the UK's R&D funding. Now, I looked at this and I was reminded back at the start of Joe Johnson's first period as universities minister, he talked a lot about a PowerPoint slide of doom, which showed an incredibly complicated system of things, which was quite hard to grasp exactly what was going on. Now, this diagram to me looks exactly like that kind of a slide. It's a complex system. And although I think that the government's instinct to make R&D work by devolving it regionally is probably the right one, who is to say that in a few years another minister will come along and will do a Joe Johnson, will look at a complicated picture and say, this is ridiculous, we haven't got any levers, we haven't got any controls, we can't do any national planning. So I kind of slightly fear that the seeds of this report's own downfall are actually in the complexity of the systems that it is proposing.
Fascinating. I think, well, you know, stepping back, research and science is having a bit of a moment. I mean, it's clear that, you know, this is where the front line of the fight against the pandemic is taking place. And it's taking place in, you know, university labs. And that's where, you know, that's where largely, you know, we're going to find a way out of this crisis, you would have thought. Jenny, do you think that it's time to cut through with the public, or do you think we're still going to end up in a distrusting of experts place when the dust settles?
Well, I'd like to hope that the current trust in experts will be sustained, and I do think it's a moment, not just to get us out of the current crisis, which will involve a huge amount of research, science, but actually to build back better, which I think that there is still a will to do. So, you know, we want to avoid future pandemics. We want to avoid adverse climate events in the future. Well, we're going to have to science our way out of this. There's a huge amount of research and innovation to be done, and not just the science, but people-centred economic and social policy as well. So I think it's a great moment for UK and international research, really, to take that moment before everyone forgets what we've learned and what we've come to value through the current pandemic.
I mean, I completely agree with that, but I would say it's not just about elements of the research agenda in universities. This is an opportunity for them, albeit facing plenty challenges, to grab the broader role of contribution to their communities and regions beyond just research done in labs. It's an opportunity. I think that there are some challenges. I appreciate David setting out what I will write in response to the report on QR funding. Yes, I always appreciate David's wisdom. Actually, it's really, really helpful. What I would say, though, is that there are, as well as costs, additional costs from being in some parts of the country, there are also additional benefits from being in some parts of the country. And I think we do need to look hard at the method by which we do our funding to take account of how we will deliver the best outcomes across the country.
Welcome to Yes But Does It Correlate, the podcast segment that takes sector data and drives it 200 miles up the A1 without stopping. The town of Barnard Castle in County Durham is a beautiful place,
and is noted in particular for easy access to opticians. But is there a higher education infrastructure that supports this local economic need? I've plotted the distance in miles as the crow flies to Barnard Castle from each UK higher education provider against the number of students studying ophthalmics in 2018-19 at each institution. Yes, but does it correlate?
I would have thought that there was no correlation and that the provision of optical courses in ophthalmics was not correlated with distance.
I'm going to go with a weak correlation. I think there might well be.
Surprisingly enough, there is no correlation. R squared is 0.048, though obviously I reserve the right to go back later on and edit that to make myself look smarter. Cardiff University has the greatest number of students studying ophthalmics at a distance of 219 miles to Barnard Castle. Data is taken from the 2018-19 HESA student dataset and from Google Maps, and where the data does not exist or is equal to zero, I have not plotted it. See you next time.
The Russell Group has released a plan to offer opportunities disadvantaged and underrepresented students, a big plan for WP. DK, talk us through it.
Now, every now and then, the Russell Group, which is the group of, which originally was the group of universities that had medical schools, but is now the group of universities that think that they offer something distinct and higher quality than others, shall we say, it's released a plan to more consistently offer opportunities for disadvantaged and unrepresented students. Now, you might think that's the kind of thing that the Russell Group comes up with quite a lot, and you're right. It is a problem that needs fixing, and the approach in this report is that although members of the Russell Group need to make a commitment, as they say, to delivering on their responsibility to diversify their campuses and support their students to reach their full potential, because of course otherwise they would not be doing that. It's also calling on government to make changes in the way, in the opportunities at schooling and other adult education to support students to the extent that more students might be able to benefit from the marvellous education that only the Russell Group can offer. So you might have picked up from that that I'm a little bit cynical about this report, that there are elements to politics that if you look deep into it, it doesn't really commit Russell Group members to make any hard changes in the way they teach or their admission policy, although we do get the standard warning that if you want Russell Group universities to take on more students from disadvantaged backgrounds, they would have to, shock horror, lower their entrance grades. So a lot of the action is on the government. There's a new office for tackling inequality. I don't like that name. I reckon you could call it something like the Office for Fair Access. I think that would be a much more pleasing title. And so as you can probably tell, I'm not a massive fan of this, but it does point to work that needs to be done. And it does once again underline the fact that a lot of a person's success in life is defined not by the university they go to, but by their background and the jobs their parents did.
I mean, there's this question about, there's just an office for tackling inequality or, you know, offer Mark II. I mean, what extent, though, is this actually a response to the access and participation agenda from the Office for Students and the changes that all universities are going to have to make when it comes to WP?
I mean, I think the first thing to say is I do admire the target that Chris Millward has set here, because actually he's forced this debate. And I'm sure that he knows that it's not within an individual university's gift to deliver on this or even a mission group, but it's something that needs to happen. And I also think, and this may be controversial, but I do think that the Russell Group is right to say this is not something we can do on our own. Tackling inequality to this level does need a sustained political will, which is something that I don't think we've seen for quite some time. And while it is about tackling educational disadvantage from birth, it's about many more things. It's about poverty. It's about the causes of poverty, wealth inequality, health. It's about community organising. But I think it's also about listening to and respecting the values of the communities that you want to attract through your doors. It's about all these things. And a university, a mission group, even the education sector can't do this on its own. So, you know, while we may not be happy with the way it's worded, actually a whole government approach to tackling this with many, many partners from across different sectors, I think is correct. Doesn't let universities off the hook. One thing it will do, and I think you've alluded to this already, is actually, if they do reach these goals, it will change Russell Group universities quite fundamentally, because they do, to you know, a greater or lesser extent, reflect the attitudes and values of the people who come through their doors at the moment. And as part of that process of more representative access, I think the culture of these universities will change quite profoundly, and it will feel like a loss. But of course, it is also a gain in so many ways, and it will help to break down the barriers between Russell Group universities and wider society, which is important if you want to carry on doing things like research and have a public will to do that.
And I'd point out the Russell Group is not a homogenous group, albeit they share the banner. And I think the approach taken by just, let's say, Newcastle, Leeds, Liverpool is pretty different to the approach taken by Oxbridge. And I think there are many very, very good things happening in many Russell Group universities. I think it's great that they're working together on this. I think it's not going to be a perfect answer, and they do need help. But surely it's a considerable step forward that we've got universities keen to take seriously their responsibility to all of our people. I think I worked with Chris Millward for years. He has a very challenging job with a limited range of instruments available to him, but a very down-to-earth and practical view of what is possible. He's, in my view, the right person to take this forward, and it's an area of the Office for Students where I think they have the public mood right. They should be putting pressure on universities, and I look forward to the Russell Group work being taken forward to better outcomes, bluntly.
My point is really, you know, a hugely challenging target like this forces you to reevaluate that, you know, you can't get there by doing more of the same, and you can't get there on your own. So the fact that this prompts a fundamental rethink of what is needed in order to create that equality, I think is helpful. Whether it will be possible to act on that, I don't know, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful it will, because the inequality that leads to the inequalities in admissions are systemic right across our society, and no one actor can tackle them alone.
I think you're right. This report is an encouraging, like, first tentative step in a way to making those fundamental changes, but we would need to see a lot more action from government and from these universities, each of them responsive to their own areas and their own local needs particularly, that I think would need to take place if we're going to make this fundamental change.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Apple Podcasts or your favourite Android podcast directory, or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to David, Jenny, DK and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen. And until next week, remain indoors.